Welcome to the Women Who Fights podcast. We empower female fighters to take full agency over their training. Our goal is to celebrate and inspire others with the incredible action women and allies are taking to level the playing field. We talk to experts, uncover prejudice, and champion what's driving our progress.
And today we have Joyce Harper with us. Joyce is an author, an academic, a scientist, and an educator. She has worked in the fields of fertility, genetics, and reproductive science and written over 230 scientific papers and published 3 books. She has so many accolades that we cannot even fit them into our intro. So we decided, so that we do it justice, to put them all on the show notes. So everyone go in there and check out how amazing Joyce is. So Joyce, thank you for coming today. We know how busy you are. Please, let's start by telling us a little bit about you, how you got where you are today, and what do you enjoy doing?
Thank you so much, Marianne and Shanti. It's really a pleasure to be here. So where do I start? So I've always wanted to be a scientist. I always wanted to figure out where everything worked, how it was all together. So I always wanted to go to university, do a PhD, and then do something that was going to really be interesting and keep me really occupied. So I had a great career after I finished. I still have a great career. As I finished my PhD, I found a job in a clinical IVF lab. Now, this was, I'm very old, this was 1978. I've got confused now. 1978 was when Louise Brown was born. That was the first IVF baby. Let me get this right. I think this rainstorm we've had today has gone to my head. So 1978 was when the world's first IVF baby was born. 1987, I'm not quite that old. 1987 was when I finished my PhD. So it wasn't even 10 years since the birth of Louise Brown. But I found a job in this field, which is less than 10 years. It's a very new field, very new area. So I started working in the fertility lab. So I was the person that when we got the eggs from the woman and the sperm, and we mixed them together in the lab, we made embryos and we froze them, and it's really exciting. But I really wanted to teach, and I really wanted to do original research. So after about 5 years, I had an office and lab in Harley Street. I was running the busiest clinic, and I thought, I need to go back to university and really teach and do research. So I did. In 1992, I went back to university and became a lecturer, and I've been running master's courses at my institute. So I work in the Institute for Women's Health, and I've been running master's courses there since 1996. But my real passion over recent years has really now been to educate the public more about women's health. And how this started was in 1987, when I started work, I actually started writing a book about women's health. And I wrote quite a lot, but I was young, I was learning in the field, and life goes by very, very quickly. And I actually published the book last year. So it's a book that, whether you want children or not, it helps you understand your anatomy, your menstrual cycle. Almost every woman goes through the menopause. So there's a chapter on the menopause. If you want to get pregnant, there's a chapter on fertility. But there's a lot about your well-being. I am an ambassador for This Girl Can. So talking to you who are doing lots of sport is really something really passionate to me. I think women do not do enough sport. You're talking to the converted here, because you're talking to women who are doing lots of sport. But it's so important. And I'm sure we all know people who don't do any exercise. And I think that's a disaster, really. So that's me sort of in a nutshell.
Amazing. I had a friend at school when we were 16 who wouldn't do any exercise because she was worried she'd get muscles.
It's amazing. People always tell me now I don't have enough time. I said, you don't have 30 minutes to look after yourself. And at my age, So I've got a really big birthday. My 60th birthday is next year, very early next year. And we have got to look after ourselves. We have really, so I've exercised always. I used to teach. I did the aerobics teacher's course decades ago. Absolutely passionate. So important. So well done, all you wonderful women on here who are doing loads of martial arts and things. I think it's brilliant. Love it. Keep it up.
Great. Can you tell us about your book and talking about the pillars of well-being? Maybe give us a little taste.
Yeah, I'll start with the pillars of well-being. So I always talk about nutrition, exercise, sleep, and our mental health. And I think we all know that lots of people don't eat well. People drink too much. Women drink too much. Again, I know women who drink alcohol every single night. And I think the view of everything in moderation is really, really important. And as I've said about the exercise, it's so, so important. And we need to do it. We need to do it through our whole lives. And I really think that will help you sail through so many things. I as I said, I always have, touch wood, you know, I don't get anything. I've got friends that are always ill, you know, and I think you can really prevent, we know the data shows you can prevent a lot of that by exercising. And then people don't sleep enough. And then yes, mental health's a whole big issue. So my book, I start with anatomy. I'm doing a lot about the menstrual cycle now, a lot about period tracker apps and fertility apps, and periods in general, from the great work of being able to go into schools and talk to young girls about how they feel about these things. And then the big bit of bad news in the book, I'm afraid, is that females do have a limited fertility life. So men, I'm sure we know, most men will stay fertile their whole lives. And I always get the kids to think about famous men who have had a child late in life. And they all say Boris Johnson first, and then Donald Trump. If you're older, what the teachers always say, Rod Stewart, Mick Jagger. The kids don't know who that is. But, you know, women, we can't do that. I say, can you think of anyone in their late 40s, early 50s, any celebrity who's had children? And there are a few. Some of those would have had egg donation, for sure. But the negative message is that, unfortunately, female fertility declines with age. And when we're adolescents, we're super fertile, when we don't want to be, probably. And then the really difficult age for most people, not everyone, this is sort of generalising, but at age 35, for most women, our fertility will start declining, due to the quantity and quality of our eggs declining. And then most women will have or be infertile by their early 40s. And that's a very negative message. And we're doing a lot of work. I run something called the International Fertility Education Initiative. And we've just published, well, just submitted a paper actually about language and about how we can use language to make sure that we don't offend. But it is very hard to give a negative message. But there are lots of other important messages within the book about our health and our well-being. And I think what we need to do is make sure people have that information so they can make an informed decision about whether they want children, what contraception they want to use, and especially around the menopause. So I'm not quite sure when the podcast is going out, but this week I'm giving the annual lecture at the British Menopause Society, and I have a paper coming out, our first study looking at asking perimenopausal women how they feel. And the biggest problem they have is that they didn't know anything. They're going into the perimenopause, so they've had symptoms, and the comments they've said are so strong. You know, why didn't I know about this? And that's a key message about our fertility, about our menstrual cycle, our reproductive health and our menopause. Why didn't I know about this before? So I think it's really important for anyone coming up to their late 30s to start getting educated about the menopause, what the symptoms are, if they need treatment, what treatments there are. And that's key to women's health. We all need to understand this. so that we can cope with this.
Definitely. I mean, I think we definitely want to talk about menopause, but I feel like we should start at the beginning of sort of like period tracking apps, sort of like that area. And then we'll get to menopause as we graduate.
I always like doing everything in order. Well done. I was just saying to Marina before I came on that I've been to her school and gave a talk to the students, and I did a talk last week with some students. It was just girls in the class, and I asked them to tell me about their periods. Did they feel that their periods were okay, or were they heavy or painful? And around half of them wrote that their periods were heavy or painful or both. We had comments such as, I've felt nauseous, I faint. A few of them, at least two already, had been diagnosed with polycystic ovarian syndrome and one with endometriosis. One of the girls told me she's had a period for 7 months. So I think this is such an important topic to just discuss with young girls. If they're having problems, my advice to them is that if you feel this is affecting your well-being, you really need to go and see someone. And you might need to really nag your GP, because this view that, oh, it's a woman's problem, you could just get on with it, it's just not acceptable. We shouldn't do that, and we should teach young women that they shouldn't do that, and they shouldn't just put up with problems that are adversely affecting their life. But then moving on, I've been doing a lot of studies around period tracker apps, and I'm a big fan. I think period tracker apps are great. I'm postmenopausal, so I've never used one, but I would have used one if I had periods. I think they're great, and I think knowing roughly when your periods come is great. But again, we've published some papers on this, and the apps don't always get it right. We're not an app. We're individual. Every woman is individual, and we're all different. So the apps don't always get the period date right. And if you're not feeling well, there's many things that, if you're anxious or stressed, there's many things that can affect the date of your period. So people shouldn't worry. And again, we've published studies on this where women told us how they felt if their period was earlier than the app or later than the app, and how reliable it was in getting it right. So I think tracking your period is great. Don't get stressed out about it if it's late or early. But there is a but. But almost all the apps tell women the day they ovulate. Now, this is very, very incorrect. So you know when your period is, and you're putting that information in the app. The date you ovulate is not a textbook either. And historically, the textbooks have said women ovulate on day 14 of their cycle. Again, I've done lots of studies around women's menstrual cycles, and women's menstrual cycles vary. There's in a very big study we did, looking at over 600,000 menstrual cycles, only 13% of women had a 28-day cycle. The vast majority, 65%, had cycles between about 25 and 30 days. So if your cycle's 25 days or 32 days, the day you ovulate is probably not going to be day 14. And again, the big studies we've done, looking at big data, actually showed that the ovulation was nearer day 17, and other studies have shown it to be day 16, 17. So unfortunately, the studies that decided you ovulate on day 14 were very old studies, they're very historic, and they were on very, very small numbers of women. A couple of them were on like 100 women. And things have moved on, and now we can be more accurate in understanding this. So one really important message: if you use a period tracker app, please don't even think about what it's saying about ovulation. It will sometimes get it right, but chances are it won't get it right. And what I hear from women is that they sometimes, if their app tells them they've ovulated, they have unprotected sex. So if you imagine if your app's telling you you've ovulated on day 14 and you're ovulating on day 17, that might be the day you start having unprotected sex, and that's exactly the day you're ovulating. So those apps are not a method of contraception. They're really not. And also, if you're trying to get pregnant, again, you might miss the day. You might, because it's just an estimate. So there are apps that market themselves as fertility apps. But again, a study we've done has shown that 50% of those are, again, only looking at dates. But there are other ways of testing whether you ovulate. So ovulation, just in case you people don't know, ovulation is the day that the egg's released from the ovary. And that's the day that's the most chance day of getting pregnant if you have unprotected sex around there. But sperm can survive in the female genital tract for up to 5 days. So if you have intercourse, say you ovulate on day 17, if you have intercourse on day 13, say, the sperm could still be there. So the sperm could still get you pregnant. So if you're trying to get pregnant, it's better to try and hit that, or as near as you can, to that day of ovulation. But there are ways of measuring it, not dates. Dates are big cross. there is an ovulation stick. It's like a pregnancy test that you just urinate on, and it measures a hormone called luteinizing hormone, which surges about 25 to 40 hours before you ovulate. So that's a really good way of finding out. It will tell you on the stick. And lots of the apps use something called basal body temperature. So you can take your temperature every morning before you get out of bed and put the temperature in the app, and it can figure out if there's a slight increase over time, and it learns about you every month. And that temperature just slightly rises on the day you ovulate. So if you're trying to get pregnant, those are ways of doing it. But for most people using an app, they're just using it for a period tracking. Please don't think about the ovulation data at all. It's so inaccurate.
And like what typically goes wrong, and what's normal with periods or with the menstrual cycle? Like, you said that different women have different lengths. Is there anything else that could define a typical menstrual cycle?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a regular, being regular, so being roughly, what's regular for you is you. So being regular each month, and your cycle roughly being around, you know, give or take 2 or 3 days, but roughly being about the same length is good, is normal. If it's very short, then that can be a bit of a worry. And if it's very long, that could be a bit of a worry. So sort of if it's under 21 days, or if it's over about 35 days, that might be a cause for concern. And then also if it varies every month, so sometimes it's short, sometimes it's long, you know, that irregular cycle. So that's also, so if it's very short, very long, or if it's irregular, again, whether you want children or not, that it's worth getting checked. It's worth going to the doctor, and ideally you want to see a gynecologist, and just saying, I'm a bit concerned about this, can we just do some hormone checks? And for irregular cycles, one of the obvious things that could be wrong is polycystic ovarian syndrome. So with this, you have more testosterone in your body, so you do have some other that you may have, that you can be a little bit hirsute. Some people put on a bit of weight. And there's other issues that you can have. Again, I'm teaching this when I go into schools. So if you have got polycystic ovarian syndrome, then there are various treatments you can have to try and regulate your cycle, which you may not be that worried about, but there may be other symptoms that you didn't realise, you didn't connect with polycystic ovarian syndrome, that can be treated. So again, any issues, any concerns, go and see your doctor, and ideally ask them to refer you to a gynecologist.
And I just want to, because I think PCOS is a really great thing to move on to next, but just before we go there, and maybe it will tie in, but we were talking before about all these women with, well, these girls with really painful periods, and they go to their GP, and, you know, you say to, you know, sort of demand help and stuff, which is totally right. But what, how do you know that the doctor is giving you what they can? Like, what should they, what are some of the options they might expect, or some of the solutions that gets offered to them? And what is like a sign that they're just being like palmed off?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It does depend. So one thing they can use is a hormonal contraception. So when you take the pill, or the implants now, the implants and the injection, you would stop your periods. So people that are having that actually, the girl that's having the 7 month, the implant didn't stop her periods. Amazing. But really, they should stop your periods. And for the contraception pill, most of you will know, we don't call it a proper period. It's just a sort of withdrawal bleed. So it should be much lighter than you were before. So yes, absolutely. If it's very painful or very heavy, this is, again, totally unacceptable. But those it's your hormones. It's your hormones being slightly out. And taking a hormonal contraceptive, not as a contraceptive, but as having an effect on your period, may help in some cases. Exercise is really up there as well. There are studies that show that women that exercise have less issues than those that don't. And being fit and healthy, and actually some teachers I've spoken to have said that they do feel that since COVID, lots of the girls they're seeing are not exercising so much. So we didn't ask them before COVID how they felt about their periods, but I just wonder how that's affected them. So I do wonder how your audience feels and whether any of them have serious problems. I'm sure they probably still do, but it should hopefully be less than for those that don't exercise at all. We've really got to keep that body strong to get through this. It's, you know, it's hard.
Absolutely. And just moving on to PCOS, can you just explain how someone might know that they have it and the steps they need to, what they can do, and also what impact it has on fertility?
Yep. So the major symptom is that you have an irregular cycle. You may not have a period at all, which, you know, sometimes you might think is a good thing, but it also is an alarm bell that something's not quite right. And so what they do, it's called polycystic ovarian syndrome, because on your ovaries, they can scan you very easily and see on your ovaries, you have lots of cyst-like structures. So that's why it's called polycystic ovarian syndrome. It's exactly what it says. There are a whole host of other symptoms. I mentioned being slightly hairy. You always see these pictures of the hairy women, and then they always say, oh, they've got polycystic ovarian syndrome. But some women are not, you know, with anything. The real message is we are individual, and you can have 10 women in a room with polycystic ovarian syndrome, and they all have different symptoms. Some will be very slim. Some will not be hairy at all. Some may be bigger. Some may be hairy. There's so many different things. Some might have quite regular cycles. You know, there's the symptoms, but we might just have one or two of them. But it can affect your mood, and it can lead to depression because your hormones are slightly out. And, you know, the hormones are so strong on our mood and our well-being. So it is worth seeing someone and then knowing the options and then deciding what you want to do. And on fertility, if you're not having a menstrual cycle, then you're not ovulating. So there are ways of trying to help you along the way and help you almost have an artificial ovulation, but you could still get pregnant, obviously, just giving you some fertility drugs. So that might be one solution for some people, but some people might need some more fertility treatment along the way. Again, there's no blanket rule. It all depends on the individual. But, you know, one of my best friends had polycystic ovarian syndrome for, you know, 30 years ago. She had two children naturally. So, you know, it doesn't mean you're definitely going to have any fertility problems
and
at all.
And the big, big, big one on alcohol and fertility. Can we talk about this? Because I think what you taught me on the day you came at the school completely changed my mindset and how I view life. So can you share that, please? Yeah. Go on, Joyce.
What did you say?
So, unfortunately, alcohol and an unhealthy diet generally is not good for your fertility. I think, again, COVID didn't help. I know lots of people that increase their alcohol consumption. But even drinking a couple of glasses of wine a night, it's not good. So if you're trying to get pregnant, anyone would tell you to really, really cut down or totally eliminate alcohol from your diet, which I know is hard. But for the man as well, we must always remember that fertility is not just us. So, you know, people market fertility tests and all this sort of thing, but it's not just us. It takes two to make a baby. So you can't just look at one side of the equation. So the guy has to do this as well. And our nutrition is so important. And what we now know is that the nutrition of the future mum and dad before they get pregnant can affect the long-term health of the child. So if, for example, again, this is a pretty hard one. I'm someone who's always struggled with my weight. But obese people, they have problems getting pregnant. It affects their fertility for sure. And on the NHS, they won't fund IVF treatment if you've got a high BMI. But it also, children of obese parents have more ongoing health problems than children of normal BMI parents. So all those things, that the whole preconception, what you do before you conceive, is really, really important. So yes, alcohol is, I love a glass of wine. I had a glass of wine last night. You know, it's great. But if we're trying to get pregnant, it's got to be in moderation. And when you get pregnant, you know, I'm sure anyone that's been pregnant will know, they change the advice every year about what you can eat. I don't know what they say now, but I was told I couldn't eat prawns, I couldn't eat, you know, prosciutto ham, you couldn't eat blah, 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 all these things. And I spoke to colleagues in other countries. I was often travelling to conferences and they said, we don't tell women that. So, why are we? So there's no concern. Everyone thinks different things. But with alcohol, unfortunately, there is quite a lot of data. I was very lucky. When I was pregnant, alcohol tasted horrible, really horrible, except champagne. So I didn't have very much. But but everything tasted horrible. Lots of things tasted horrible to me. So unfortunately, if we're trying to get pregnant, both people need to really cut down on alcohol. And actually, if we talk about pregnancy, we've also just been doing a study asking women who went through fertility treatment about the amount they exercised. Because again, I'm absolutely advocating exercise, but too much exercise can be bad when you're trying to conceive. I'm sure you know that, you know, some elite athletes, their periods stop, their menstrual cycles stop. It may be because they've become too lean, but yeah, we can affect that absolutely by exercising. So exercise is absolutely recommended when you're trying to get pregnant, but not excessive. Now, how do you work out what's excessive? Because what's excessive for one person is not going to be excessive for another person. Unfortunately, I don't have the answer. Nobody has the answer. So we have to use our own judgment. But, you know, I wouldn't be running a marathon if I was trying to get pregnant. But I would be doing a 5K jog every couple of days. So we have to be sensible about it. And I wouldn't do anything. I think with everything, nothing too extreme, everything in moderation when we're trying to get pregnant.
I recently found
0% beers. They taste like normal beer. Really good.
Are they good? I don't know why you drink that though. But I was just about to say, so I'm a cold water swimmer, and we're in the middle of doing a project now to ask women whether they feel cold water swimming helps their menstrual and menopause symptoms. And so far, the data's showing absolutely. They really love it. They really feel it helps. Don't look so horrified. But
cold water.
Well, we've asked them why. How?
How does cold water help the period symptoms?
Well, we don't know. Nobody... Listen, one unfortunate thing is there's so little research being done on all of these topics.
Joyce Harper.
Why? Is it 2022 and we don't...
And I'm working on it. It's the next one.
All I can do. But no, we're asking... they have been telling us that the biggest two actually were that they feel it helps their physical and mental health. But some of them, we did wonder, is it because you're with cold water swimming is normally very social, but that was actually the lowest response so far. It's actually been, and we did ask whether it's being in nature. I do a lot about positive psychology. Positive psychology, one of the things is actually being outside and enjoying your environment. But no, they actually said that the two top were the actual having the effects on their body, both physically and mentally. They felt Joyce, that it really helped.
Where do you swim?
All over the place. Lakes, rivers and the sea.
On a cold day? On a cold day.
You look horrified. Every day, every week. I haven't missed a week for a year and a half now. In my swimming costume.
Did you do that on the weekends? Like you go to locations?
Yeah. Yeah. In lockdown. Wow. I did it during lockdown, so I wouldn't go mad. Listen, it's amazing. But one of the things, all the exercise, it moves the blood around our body. And it helps our heart, it helps our lungs, it helps our brains. It's just wonderful. Any exercise is wonderful. But yeah,
Chantal, we should join. We should join Joyce.
Your face.
If my heart doesn't stop,
I've
it will be great.
I've actually just started about a week ago. I decided to start. I was staying in Pembrokeshire and I've been swimming in the sea every morning. And it was like, you know, when like, I feel amazing. I'd be in the water and I'd just start smiling, and then I'd keep smiling until the next morning, and then I'd be like, I need my hair.
Don't you feel the one experience I had with Dorset was I went in and I froze. What do you do? How do you overcome the first loss of breath?
You breathe.
Breathe. It's all about breathing. It's breath. But you've got it right, Shanti. It's addictive. It feels like a hit.
It's addictive.
Honestly, it feels like a drug.
It does. It's better than coffee. It lasts longer.
Oh yeah, Joyce is not drinking coffee,
so I don't know. But everyone. Everyone says I look a lot better since I've been swimming. They said I look. People have said, "What are you doing? You look so good." I don't know.
There's a lot in it, I think, and it's meant to. I've heard some sort of anecdotal stuff about it helping autoimmune disorders. I mean, that's very, you know, I don't know studies, but like it's something that goes round.
Yeah,
and I think it gets all the blood there.
Yeah, we're looking at women's. So when you're pregnant again, they advise swimming, not cold water swimming, it's normal swimming. So we're writing some guidelines about. We're looking at the research that has been done, and we're trying to identify the gaps. But we're going to let women know what actual evidence there is about that. So exercise generally. During all of these stages is really important, but I'm sure your listeners know. You've got to listen to your body, and do what's right for you. But yeah, at certain times it needs to, it may need to be moderate, but then at other times you can do whatever you like, what you feel good to do.
Yeah, cool. I mean, I was also talking to my cousin about. She's the person who linked us up actually, and she's studying fertility, and she says it's sort of it's going down. Do you know about that, and can you talk to us a little bit about like why that might be and if there's anything people can do?
I mean, the evidence about it going down is really patchy. But what we are doing is we're having children later. So the studies we've done, we've asked women and men when they want, what's their ideal age to have children? And incredibly, most people do say around age 30. That's their ideal age. It might not be the age they actually do. And you know, I wanted children. 30 years ago, I wanted children at 30. But then, long story. But the latest data from the UK statistics, which came out in February, showed that for the first time in the UK, over half of women at age 30 had not had a child. So what we want and what's actually happening are two different things. And in a large number of countries, people have looked at the global data of the average age women have their first child. And in many countries, it's close to age 33, 34. So if you look at this data, every year, the age women actually have children is going up and up and up. So this is a problem. And in many countries, even Greece and Poland and other Italy, the average number of children a woman will have is about 1.3, 1.4. And again, when we've asked people, they want 2 to 3 children, not 1 to 2 children. So we're not having the desired family size. We've got a large number. There's 20% of women in the UK past fertility age who don't have children. So some of those absolutely would have been by choice. We, you know, it's absolutely, this is a choice thing. And there does seem to be a growing number of men and women who choose not to have children. But some of them would be because they've missed the boat and they're trying too late and then they're not getting success.
So with that said, we know what the fertility window for women are. What are some ways to work around it?
So how do you mean work around
So still have children, not miss the boat, but also not putting their... Because it could be that it's the reasoning behind delaying it is to work on their career, become financially more stable. So... are there any ways that they could work around that?
You're absolutely right. We've asked them what factors influence the age they want to have children. And absolutely, career is still number one. In our survey we did, number two was that they were ready, but they didn't have a partner who was ready. And that was my problem in my early 30s. My partner wasn't ready. I'm sure many of your listeners will go, yeah, I know about that. And then the third was their finances. They wanted to sort their finances out. Now, in the UK, we have a problem that we don't provide really good maternity, paternity pay. It's not as bad as the US, for example.
No,
we don't even go there at the moment.
It's another episode.
Don't even go there. But it's pretty... That's another episode, yeah. But it's, if you look at Sweden have got fabulous arrangements for when you want to have a child. And they have a lot less issues than we have because you can have a child at 30 and take a gap in your career. But I'm sure you all know that there's a big worry, and we all heard stories of our friends who, you know, took their career break and then had problems getting back or weren't offered the same job. And then as a young mum trying to get on in your career, most people, I certainly felt like this, we feel like we're juggling everything, drowning, not doing anything well. We're not good at work. We're not a good partner. We're rubbish mum, we're tired, we're stressed, we're juggling too many balls. So it's a really, really hard. And you know, our nursery care here, there's excellent nursery care, but it's so expensive. So again, in countries like Sweden, it's really subsidised and excellent, you know, just offered to everybody. So we have to change the culture. So my youngest are 16. I've got twins who are 16. And, you know, after kids, you have a brilliant life. You'll do all the wonderful things that, you know, it's not like having kids is, you know, stopping everything. But it's a hard transition to keep that career going. And I bring up a family. It's really hard. It is hard. So we definitely need to improve it. So we have a thing in universities called Athena Swan. And Athena Swan is trying to make a supportive working environment. So originally it was aimed at women, but obviously now with equality and diversity, it's just aimed at anyone who is caring for other people. So maybe someone that's caring for their parents or whoever. So for example, before our Athena Swan discussions, we used to have meetings at 8 a.m. or 6 p.m. So they stopped all of that. They made everything within a much smaller working day. And that now with online, we've got even more flexible. So I think we can use this as an advantage of COVID, of making more flexible working arrangements. So for example, even if you were trying to get pregnant, going through fertility treatment, you need time off work. So that's really important. All these things are being discussed now. So this year we set up something called Reproductive Health at Work. So we're going into companies and talking to them about all the things I'm talking to you about, but also talking to them about how this can affect their staff. So it's not just women, it's men as well. Men are going through fertility treatment too. If there's a miscarriage, it's affecting men and women. We're going into companies now and talking through some of the things, which they're sort of sitting there saying, oh, yeah, I should have thought about that. You know, I hope, but I don't think this is the case, I hope that all companies now have period products in the toilets. But I don't think they do. But they should be there. They should be in every toilet. There should be women, if they're having a really heavy period or a really painful period, should be able to stay at home. They shouldn't have to work. That's you know, if you had food poisoning or something, you wouldn't be going into work. And if you're incapacitated, you shouldn't have to come into work. And that should be acceptable. You know, I can remember years ago, people saying, oh, she seems to have a day off every month. Okay, she's having a really bad period. She should have a day off every month. It shouldn't be questioned. So we need all of these things. If they're having fertility treatment, and there's a bill going through at the moment, companies will have to let employees take off time. You know, if you're having an operation for anything else or treatment for anything else, you'd have to take time off work, and you should for fertility treatment. But there's always been that worry, I think, of discussing that you're trying to get pregnant with your boss and then feel like you may be stigmatised, and that they'll think, oh, if they get pregnant, they're going to take maternity leave. But that's historic. We have got to move forward with the times. And then, you know, even when we get to the menopause, people need time off if they have a miscarriage. They need time, you know. But are there employers there are some employers, but all employers need to give people time to recover from these things and have compassionate leave. And then the menopause as well. We need a lot more flexible working environment. So it's really important. We're not the only ones. There's other groups as well that are going into companies and starting to educate them about all of these really, really important issues. So we're doing from the menstrual cycle to the menopause.
Hmm. And is with just to, before we move on, with the fertility treatment, I'm assuming that all of the help that you need to get it, as in, I guess, eating well, making sure you're fit and healthy and not stressed, there is it's the same for the fertility treatment.
All to get of stages of our life, it's the same. Yeah, it's always the same. Mm. We've got to look after those pillars of well-being. So we've got to look after our nutrition, our exercise, our sleep and our mental health, which includes obviously being stressed. So it's so important to try and balance those through our lives. It's absolutely important for men as well, but men don't have to go through all these things that we go through. They don't have to go through a menstrual cycle, periods. They don't go through a pregnancy directly. And the menopause, they go through all of these things indirectly, but not directly. So this life course of women's health is really, really important. And it's really important for us even more to really try and be as healthy as we can. And it will definitely help. It will help us go through that for sure.
And with the menopause, moving on to that section, can we talk about symptoms and how to alleviate symptoms? And is there anything you can do in the build up to menopause, you know, the years prior that can then help?
So I've had so many friends talk to me about, oh, I've got a migraine and I'm a bit depressed and I'm a bit anxious. And I say, you're perimenopausal. Those are all menopause symptoms. And they say, no. No, you are. So it's really important for everyone. Ideally, everyone needs to learn about the menopause symptoms when they're in their 30s. So because so many people have been asking me, I've made a YouTube video a few weeks ago. It's on my YouTube channel. And I've just talked about the short-term symptoms and the long-term symptoms, because they are seriously going to affect your working life, your home life, your sex life. And so many people don't realise, they don't join the dots. And they don't realise that they're not going mad. They're not, you know, it's the hormones. And if, you know, in puberty, the hormones are cycling up and these hormones are so powerful. And because they're unstable and they're roller coasting, that's what makes teenagers sort of have unreasonable behaviour and all the other symptoms that they have. And in the menopause, we're doing the opposite. But the symptoms are very, some of them are very similar, because one day our hormones might be high, or one might be high and one might be low. The next day it's the opposite. They're all over the place. So when you're postmenopausal, you are level. You've either got none, or if you're taking HRT, then you've got a level dose. But before that, but in the perimenopause, you're all over the place. So it's that roller coaster that gives you all these symptoms. So there are two types of symptoms. There's short-term symptoms that would normally stop postmenopause. You know, some things women might, they know about hot flushes, but depression, anxiety, migraines. Oh, all my friends have migraines. You know, aches in your joints, you know, joint ache, muscle ache, fatigue. So, you know, women training, for example, might just not, you know, and lack of motivation. So they might just, they might just be finding it really, really hard to exercise anymore. So as I said, there's a whole bunch of short-term symptoms. And then there's but they normally go. But some of them can affect your sex life. So it includes vaginal dryness and vaginal itching, or genital itching. The whole area can be itchy. And again, that normally goes. But there are really simple ways of treating that. People could just use a pessary cream with some estrogen in to help that. So ways to alleviate it, absolutely exercise, number one, and our nutrition, looking after ourselves. So going back to alcohol, you know, alcohol makes you hot. It can make you depressed the next day. So many of the menopause symptoms are similar to the effects of alcohol. So the trouble is, if you're affecting sleep, for example, as well. So if you're drinking a lot of alcohol when you're perimenopausal, it can make everything much, much worse. So one of the first things is to really cut it down. And caffeine, unfortunately. Back to caffeine. Exercise and nutrition and getting good sleep. You can be affected with hot flushes in at night sweats. and then looking after our mental health are really important. But if you feel that you're doing all of those and you're managing everything, and you still have really bad symptoms, there are obviously other treatments. So there's hormone replacement therapy, which can really help many, many of these symptoms, if not all of them. But it does vary between different women. There's lots of different doses. There's lots of different ways of administering it. So you really need to find someone who's going to help tailor this to you. So we're trying to say that what we need is every GP needs to be able to understand the symptoms. And then ideally, in every practice, there should be a menopause expert who can help you with the treatments. And if you take HRT, they can really help you figure out what's the right treatment for you. So it's really, really important.
Now that you've mentioned HRT, could we talk a little bit about it for those that don't know what HRT is and what's your opinion on it? Because there have been quite a few people that are like, no, HRT is demonized, absolutely not. So what's your opinion? Too many questions.
Yeah, it's absolutely, it's brilliant, absolutely individual. And there are definitely different camps out there when you read things. I think that if a woman's having really severe symptoms, she should absolutely not be suffering and she should try HRT and see if it works for her. But what we have now, so there was some research in sort of 20, 30 years ago that was never quite, you know, you have to look at about how you interpret it. But it said there was HRT could cause an increase in breast cancer. Okay, now I don't believe that everyone's talked about this research forever, and I really think that most people feel that it was old. It was different types of HRT. If you look at it in different ways, you know, being obese has the biggest effect, and alcohol on breast cancer actually. Than HRT. So I think people keep bringing those studies up, but I think they're by the by. But there are some people, some very prominent menopause specialists who say that every woman should take HRT forever. And this is what I felt the narratives have been of some of the recent documentaries. There was one where the very last word was from the private GP. And the presenter said, so how long should you take HRT for? And the last word from the GP was, you should take it till the day you die, or something like that, or forever. I can't remember exactly what she said. I don't agree with that. I personally didn't want to take it. I didn't have that bad symptoms, so I've never taken it. I'm 13 years post-menopause. I've never taken it. I feel the best, I think, that I've ever felt in my life. I really, really do. I think my menstrual cycles were... Now I look back, I was like... Oh. Even I was on the pill for years as well, but I still think I was all... I think I was like this every month, up and down and up and down and up and down. And now I just feel... I feel high. I feel high all... You know, very stable, and I love that feeling. I love it. So for me, I didn't want to take it because I didn't feel I needed it. And I get upset when the narrative seems to be every woman should take it. They're all, yeah. I heard one talk that basically said, I'm putting some words in his mouth, but he basically said, if you're post-menopause and you want a good sex life, you have to take HRT. I was just like... Anyway, I questioned him. He said, I didn't say that. You did. You did say that. I was like, wow, really? So they're saying that no woman... If any woman that doesn't take HRT has rubbish sex. That's not true. That's really not true. So I think now what we've got... is pressure on women to take it. There's also been some comments around dementia. And again, on one of the programmes, it suggested that if you didn't take HRT, you were going to increase your chance of dementia. And the British Menopause Society and the Royal College of Obs and Gynae put out a position statement recently and made it very clear that that is not what the evidence shows. There is no evidence at this moment in time. Maybe there might be in the future, but it just, you know, I just didn't want to take any hormones. And I feel amazing. I'm not the only person that doesn't take HRT. So I think if you want to take HRT, I absolutely support that. That's, you know, for some women, it really works. I've got friends that call it their happy hormone. You know, absolutely, it's been a lifesaver, a big changer for them. I've met women who don't want to take it, want to be more holistic and more natural. And then women that have had breast cancers and some other cancers, these are hormone sensitive, so they can't take it. There's some women who can't, it would be dangerous for them to take it. And I've spoken to some of those women, and some of them are like, I feel guilty now because I can't take it. And I'm being told but that I should, you know, that if you don't take it, it's not good for you not to take it. So, yeah. I think we need to equilibrate this, and we need to give women the options of treatments and let them decide what they want to do and how long they want to do it. We shouldn't be forcing everybody to have one. As I said, we're all individual. There's no one size fits all. What works for you might not work for the next person. So we should know the options, choose what we want to choose when we want to choose
it. There's also one more thing that came into my mind. Hair loss. Is there... So that's a symptom of menopause. Is there anything that can be done to save or prevent it? Because that's a big impact on how women feel when they're losing their hair.
Yeah, certainly. And there are some women, one of my really good friends who's a menopause advocate, she's got the receding, it's got a proper name, but they don't get it like a man would get bald, but that whole hair just sort of recedes back slightly. And that can happen. Hers isn't thinning. Hers has just... all, you know, it's sort of like a couple of inches has got all the way round. So her hairline is much further back, but it's not like a guy that would sort of thin and you'd get the peaks and things. It's just totally the same, but an inch back. So there are some long-term issues that can happen. Hair thinning for sure. There's no magic cure. I wish there was. But
I've seen adverts on the tube, you know, you spray it. Oh, it's hair, like restoring. A really, yeah.
I was just going to use the example of Elton John. If Elton John, I mean, his hair looks much better now, but, you know, sort of 10 years ago, he had a disaster on his head. And I said, if Elton John can't get good, he's a multi-millionaire.
Then menopause, a woman wants,
you know. So I've had friends that have had hair transplants, and I didn't realise it doesn't last very long. I think another positive thing is I think we are embracing changes that happen. So. We're a lot more, young people are a lot more comfortable with being bigger, I think a few years ago there was a lot of body shaming, but I think now with the plus size models and things, I think it's having an effect. I was recently at a festival where the age was very young, and every shape and size was wearing whatever they wanted. I loved it. I thought it's great. You know, people are not worrying so much now. I think it's very positive. So I think with things like hair loss and, you know, other things that can happen, I think we're getting more accepting of things that happen to people. I was reading something about a male model who's got loads of freckles, which, you know, I think maybe 10 years ago, people would have said, oh, he looks weird. But now he's a successful model. You know, we've embraced those differences in people, which I think is terrific. So I hope that that's the way we deal with it. We just don't make it a negative thing, but make it a positive thing.
Yeah. So is what are the studies that have been done on menopause, just before we move on, on like menopause and the menstrual cycle? And because obviously women are underrepresented hugely in studies, so how does it fare in a very specifically female space?
Yeah, there haven't, that we are way, 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 way behind on our research. I think things are really improving. I think we're catching up. So my main research has been to ask women how they're feeling about these things. So I've been doing lots of survey-based research. And I think one thing that's really fabulous is that the UK, well, England now have this Women's Health Strategy. So the Women's Health Strategy is going to do more research. It's going to give women better access to treatments. And they're doing a huge amount of research. And Dame Leslie Regan has just been announced as our first ever Women's Health Ambassador. And she's a friend of mine. She's amazing. She has been president before the Royal College of Obs and Gynae. She's done so much amazing work. So I do think it's a very positive time. And I think all the issues we've spoken about are on their agenda. They're all on their agenda. We've got people now going into companies to talk about all of this. The narrative is there. We've got the discussions going. The research will follow. And I think it's a really great time. It's really, really exciting and really positive. But if I was doing this 5 years ago, I wouldn't have said the same thing. I think the last 5 years have been really important for women's health generally.
Lovely. So how do we, to wrap up then, how do we stay well when we hit our 40s? And what adjustments we might need to make, both mentally and physically? Like a blanket rule.
Yeah, so what's really important is for women to understand that they will never be too young to be going through the menopause. So they need to, so don't think at 42, I'm getting a hot flush, I'm too young to go through the menopause. No such thing. The average age women, so the menopause actually means you've been for 1 year without having a period. And the average age that women go for a year without having a period is age 51. And these symptoms start up to 10 years before that. And when I say the average age is 51, that means a lot of women are going to be much younger than that. So in their 40s, you know, roughly half will be in their 40s and half will be over 51. So if you're going through the menopause at 45, you could have menopause symptoms when you're 35. So never think you're too young. Find out about what the symptoms are. And again, they're in my book and they're on the YouTube video. They're several places. And if you're experiencing them, join up the dots. And don't listen to your GP if he says, or they say, sorry, they say, oh, you're too young to go through the menopause. Okay, it's really not a thing. It's really not a thing at all. So being fit and healthy, really looking after your body, as I said, those four pillars of well-being, nutrition, exercise, sleep, and mental health. And I think we need to be as positive as we can in our life. I'm a really positive person. I think being positive is a really good state of mind to be in. But if you're feeling like you're losing motivation and you're suffering some mental health issues, etc., you know, think about the menopause first. Go and seek some help, because that will seriously affect you and your work-life balance. And it's something that you, once you understand, then you can say, oh, okay, this is what's happening. And then post-menopause, hopefully, you'll feel fabulous and you'll be in this new time of your life when you've ticked many boxes and you can do whatever you want to do. Go cold water swimming. I've been kayaking this morning.
Oh my God.
You can go do whatever you like to do. So,
beautiful.
You know, it's life's great. It can be as fabulous as you want to make it. So be positive, be educated, be informed, understand. It's really, the message is understand your body and understand how it's going to change. Mm. And embrace that body and make it strong.
I love that. And I just had a thought as well, because everyone varies so much as to when they get married. When they start becoming perimenopausal, is there any evidence to suggest what influences the age you get it?
Fantastic question, Shanti. A very rough rule of thumb is the age your mother went through the menopause. Lots of people say, oh, my mum won't speak about it, or she doesn't know, or whatever. But if she does, I met someone recently who'd already gone through the menopause, and they did it a lot before their mum. If you smoke, there's a lot of research. If you smoke, even passive smoking, you can go through the menopause 2 to 3 years earlier. There's nothing you can do really. Taking a hormonal contraception or the pill or anything won't prevent it, won't make it later. It doesn't affect it. All the research is, it doesn't affect it. So, yeah, we don't know enough about it. And I wish there was a test. I wish there was a test that would say you're going to do this in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. But there isn't. There isn't. And so we just need to know what might happen and roughly when it might happen, and then make a decision about what we want to do with those stages of our lives.
Mm, definitely. And also, you mentioned how positive you are as a person, and earlier you talked about positive psychology. Is positive psychology just I'm being positive, or is there actually a school of psychology?
Yeah,
called positive psychology.
It's a wonderful story. I met the person who's written The Little Book of Happiness and who teaches positive psychology. We met on a TV program. It was Comedians Give Lectures. I don't know if you've seen any of them. But the comedians are given a topic, a science or medical topic, and then they have to make a funny sketch about it. So we were both on it. We were the experts with the work with the comedian. And I've actually done her positive psychology course. It was great. I think it's one of those things where probably everyone on there was already very positive. But it really made me think about how I talk to people. I was doing an appraisal recently, for example, and in our job, we can do lots and lots of different things. So one of my colleagues that we were appraising was doing lots and lots of different things. And I said to her, in the morning, if you had a blank day and you wanted to fill it, what would you do first? What jumps out at you? You think, oh, I really want to do that. And that's what I got from the positive psychology. You have to think about what's your meaning? What's your sense of meaning in your day, in your week, in your year? I'm a big fan of vision boards. So I do a vision board with a group of friends every January. And I think about it in November, December, January to think about what do I want next year? What do I want to happen? And for me, they work really, really well, really well, because they've made me think about what's going to make my life happy next year. What's going to give me a sense of meaning? What's going to give me pleasure? And again, I think it's wonderful to start thinking more about what you want. What do you, and for your career, you know, where do you want the career to go? For many years, my book was on my vision board, and now it's done. So I had almost a blank page about what I wanted to do. So I think, being positive, waking up in the morning and being really positive about the day. But yes, there is a movement that will help teach you how to do that. So Miriam Akhtar's Little Book of Happiness. She was the person I met. So highly recommend it. It's only little. Yeah.
Based on what you're doing, what you've done so far, I bet the vision boards were full of stuff, Joyce, throughout the years.
The very first one was a mess. I was like, oh, my brain is mad. It's crazy. But I've streamlined it.
Is there any tip you can give us if we should, like, I'm really keen in having a vision board, but is there any tip on what, like, how you can stream?
So I have a website called Global Women Connected. It's where I just write my blogs. And on Global Women Connected, mm-hmm. if you just search vision boards, I've written a little piece about how you can do them. Actually, I've also done a little video on YouTube about how to do them. So I've done them many. Mm-hmm. I think I've done them about 8 or 9 years. But they're really, and they're great to do with a bunch of friends, glass of wine, coffee. socially.
Love that.
But yeah, they're great. They're great.
We should link them in our notes. And the last question, which links a little bit to what makes you wake up every day and, you know, feel positive. Our final question is, what are you fighting for, Joyce Harper?
What am I fighting for? I'm fighting to ensure that every woman is educated about her health. That's definitely my mission for the next last, unfortunately, 10 years of my career. I just want to sort out this education. I wish I'd done it in 1987, when I started writing a book, but better late than never. I really want to be out there with women and men, teaching them about their reproductive health. And that's what I'm fighting for. That's what gets me out of bed every morning.
We need more people like you.
For sure.
We need way more people like you. Thank you so much for your time.
There are lots.
Thank you, Joyce.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Women Who Fight podcast, and credit to Will Grant for being our songwriter and sound editor. Please subscribe and share and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at womenwhofight.co.uk, and check out our website for more content.